Good morning, everyone. I call the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee to order on Wednesday, March 4th, 2026. There is a quorum present. And the first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes. Representative Smith, may I have a motion to approve the minutes from Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026?
Yes, Chair. I move to approve the minutes of March 3rd, 2026.
Representative Smith moves the minutes for Tuesday, March 3rd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. All right. So the first up thing on our second item on our agenda today is a presentation from the Minnesota Office of the Attorney General on the Consumer Data Privacy Act. And I would like to welcome Assistant Attorney General Miko and Deputy Attorney General Whitney to the testifiers table. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Caitlin Miko, Assistant Attorney General. I work at the Attorney General's Office in the Consumer Protection Division. I'm joined with Deputy Attorney General Jessica Whitney. We appreciate your invitation to present today and look forward to the opportunity to discuss an overview of the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act, summarize our first 6 months of enforcement, and discuss our priorities going forward. Okay, so in May of 2024, the Minnesota Consumer Data Privacy Act was signed into law. This made Minnesota the 18th state to pass such a law, and in doing so, joined the ranks of a growing number of states that are taking steps to protect consumer privacy. And this reflects the reality of today's digital age, where there's an incredible volume and variety of personal data that's being collected, stored, and analyzed, and creates a real potential for the loss of privacy or other harms like financial fraud, harassment, surveillance, or even physical harm. The law went into effect on July 31st, 2025, and it has a few core components. First, it affords Minnesotans new rights over their data. They have more control over who is collecting and maintaining their data and what they're doing with it. It also imposes obligations on businesses that are all designed to protect consumer privacy. The law is enforced by the AG. There is no private right of action, and comes with significant penalties. Also want to mention that the law provided for a notice or warning letter requirement where for the first 6 months that the law was effective, our office was required to send a warning letter to any target identifying the potential violations before we could bring an enforcement action. And so as we'll talk about, this means for the first 6 months, our real priority was to stress education and work with companies through educational outreach and opportunities, and also through these warning letters to gain their compliance and to educate and hope that they adjusted to comply with the law. That requirement has now expired as of January 31st. And now we're coming up on about 2 years since the law was passed. So we are moving into an enforcement posture. And given that this area is really quite ripe for enforcement, we do expect meaningful settlements in the coming years. So let's talk about the scope of the law. Our law follows a similar framework to that of other states. And it really is centered around essentially two questions. The first being, if a business collects the data of more than 100,000 consumers, then they'd fall within the scope of the law, or if they're in the data business and they derive more than a quarter of their gross revenue from the sale of personal data, that also brings them within the scope of the law. I noted on the slide here there are exemptions, both what we call entity level, where the entire entity is no longer subject to the law if they meet certain requirements. There's also data level exemptions where if certain data that a company is collecting is already regulated by a law like HIPAA or the GLBA, then that data is not subject to the law. Okay, so for businesses that are subject to the law, there are several clear requirements. For example, businesses need to be transparent about what data they collect and why and to whom it's shared. There's also an affirmative obligation to safeguard the data. They need to have reasonable security practices. And they have to obtain consent before they collect certain types of data, namely sensitive data. And that's a defined term, which includes things like specific location or any data about children under 13, and then other important points like a person's racial or ethnic origin, religion, sexual orientation, or citizenship status. There's other obligations here too, but I'll leave it there. In terms of consumer rights, as I mentioned, the MCDPA empowers Minnesotans with key rights over their personal data. So as of last year, Minnesotans can now ask a company, what information are you collecting about me? I would like a copy of that, maybe to move to a different company. And they can also, very importantly, ask that their data be deleted. They can also opt out of the sale of their data, profiling, and opt out of targeted advertising, which is essentially saying, while you're browsing on the internet, I don't want to be subject to targeted advertising, and I don't want my data sold. So in the first 6 months, we assembled a team. We hired additional attorneys and an investigator. And I should note that when the bill was passed in 2024, the AG's office was funded at a lower amount in the out years than the fiscal note called for. And I mention this because the AG's office is seeking to get these funds so we can be fully staffed as intended. But we placed a strong emphasis on educational outreach. We participated in many presentations, CLEs, conference calls, webinars. We did this both with the public. We were at festivals and the state fair. We also put on a lot of CLEs with both industry, corporate affinity groups, as well as legal industry. Again, our goal being to educate the public about the law and to gain their compliance. We also put up a website with frequently asked questions and template letters for consumers to use, information specific to consumers and information specific for businesses. And we prepared a privacy-specific complaint portal where we received more than 200 complaints in just the first 6 months, which is pretty high volume. And these complaints were, by and large, related to consumers trying to exercise their rights. They mostly are looking to delete their data and are running into trouble with that. In response to these complaints or other concerns, we issued many warning letters, as I mentioned earlier, as required by the statute. And many companies took prompt steps to address the issues we flagged or cooperated with our request. But nearly all of these have required additional follow-up, and some have developed into early investigations. Our early observations of the first 6 months are, offer two. The first being, unsurprisingly, Minnesotans care a lot about their privacy. They're excited about the law, they want to exercise these rights, and they want to learn more about how to do it. On the other hand, we have seen and observed quite extensive non-compliance. There are a lot of companies who have not fully embraced the requirements of the law, and there's really a target-rich environment for our enforcement actions. And so again, we reasonably expect that given the tools provided by this law and the substantial penalties associated, that we'll be bringing meaningful settlements in the near term. And so as we shift from an enforcement focus to really an enforcement posture, we are going to be prioritizing the areas of most importance to Minnesotans. We're not really that interested in the ticky-tack violations, and rather we're going to be looking for where we can make the biggest impact and set the tone going forward. And so these are going to look like in cases involving sensitive data. As I mentioned earlier, this is by its definition the most vulnerable data that can bring harm to Minnesotans. So we're going to be looking to make sure that Minnesotans that companies are getting the required consent in order to process sensitive data before they collect or store it. Likewise, the universal opt-out mechanism is kind of a clunky term, but it is an important component of the law, which allows consumers to rather than at every single website they visit or every single business they encounter, assert their consumer privacy rights, do a one-time signal where they're telling businesses, I don't want to be targeted, I don't want you to sell my data. We've observed that there's large non-compliance with this and companies are not honoring this signal, so we intend to focus on that. We're going to continue to make sure that consumers have success in asserting their consumer rights, and so when folks write to our office, we're going to make sure we follow up and ensure that Minnesotans are able to exercise their privacy rights. And then lastly, transparency is important. We expect businesses to be clear about what they're doing with the consumers' data and disclose that to consumers, and we will hold them to that. So I'll conclude my presentation by thanking the committee for inviting us today, and I'll be happy to take questions or follow-ups.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I just is it the end of the testimony?
Yes.
Thank you. I just really want to thank Representative Elkins, too, for, working on this legislation and making sure that we got this past the finish line. I think this is kind of one of those new frontiers, all our personal data. And so I hope we're ahead of the curve here in Minnesota. One question I had is that universal opt-out, like the letter they send you and you sign it, and then it says you're opted out forever and you have to mail it back? How does that universal sign-out work?
Yeah,
or opt-out work?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good question. It works primarily by two ways. Either the consumer uses a privacy-protective browser with it already built in, or you download an extension to your browser, and that would function as the signal that goes to your any websites you're visiting, that you do not want to be subject to targeted advertising, profiled, or you don't want them to sell your data.
Thank you.
Yep.
And is that prominent on the website?
It takes some work to do. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it takes some effort for consumers to put that into place, unless they already use a privacy protective browser. And that's why we have some educational materials on our website about that. And that's why we think it's so important that if consumers are going to the lengths of making sure that they're using the right tools, that companies are honoring that signal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair. So a couple of just real quick questions. I know, like, when I'm going to the consumer rights here, you have under the E and D that edit and delete. What happens if the companies don't go through with either editing or deleting based on what the consumer gave them? Is there, what happens beyond that?
Ms. Miko?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. If I understand your question right, the company is required to respond to a consumer rights request within 45 days. And if they decline to act on the consumer's request, they need to tell the consumer that, which would then allow the consumer to take further action by, you know, following up with the company or contacting our office.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair. And last question is, I'm concerned. I came from state government, the state government committee, and I really am concerned about this with your office, Deputy AG. We've been putting more things on your department for several years now. We really haven't upped your budget for more staff. My concern is that because we're putting more and more on your department, you need more staff? I mean, that's stuff like this and everything. So.
Ms. Whitney.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you for that concern. This was funded, and it was fully funded for the first year. And then I think through a miscommunication, it got the funding decreased by, was it $250,000 for the second year? I think because you all thought we were going to be able to take some of the enforcement money and keep it, but all of the enforcement money goes back to the general fund except for that CIPRA fund we all talked about 2 weeks ago when I was here. So if we could get it funded fully going forward, that would be ideal because we were able to hire some new folks, but not as many as I think you all wanted and we think would be necessary. This is an incredibly important area. As Caitlin was saying, we've seen a lot of violations already. We've got subpoenas, civil investigative demands out, and are looking at what we can do to enforce it when companies don't do what they're supposed to do and don't edit or delete people's information.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to, first of all, pile on with Representative Hewitt and staff here, but we do need some extra funding. We got extra funding to set up the office in the original bill, but, you know, given the workload, we didn't provide all the funding that was described in the fiscal note for the bill, and so we do need some money from StakeUp to fully staff the department, this group. And then in terms of the universal opt-out, the two browsers that have the best capabilities right now are DuckDuckGo and Mozilla Firefox. It's pretty easy. I use Firefox as my primary browser for that reason, and it's pretty easy to set it up.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Dawson.
Thank you, Chair. Question I've got is, what do we have for, you mentioned that we're now rolling into enforcement and penalties. Can you explain what that looks like? And a follow-up question would be is, what are we doing to make sure that this isn't weaponized against small businesses as we move forward as well?
Assistant AG.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So first of all, small businesses are exempt from, small businesses as defined by the SBA are exempt from the law, except that they are still prohibited from selling sensitive data. Okay. So that's a critical point to your question. In terms of penalties, the statute calls for up to $7,500 per violation, which is substantial when you talk about the nature of this work. It will add up quickly. So we're going to be going after, you know, what we see as the most critical violations, so that, again, we're not really interested in the ticky-tack violations, because you can basically go to any website and find a problem with their privacy notice. It's not that hard to find violations, but we're going to be looking for what is most important to Minnesotans and really focusing in on that.
Representative Dodson. Representative Faulkner.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I think just to kind of step back, just wondering, when you mentioned groups, data, I'm assuming kind of data brokers that are compiling all this information, where, how do they actually get the data? Like, where are they getting it from? But then could you explain, too, what do they do with it? Because I think it would just be important to set the table on why people should opt out if that's what they want to do.
Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. data brokers are in the business of scraping data from any and all websites. I'm not a data broker expert, but my understanding is from any and all public sources, but also importantly from like apps and activity on online. So some websites are working with companies to track what you're doing online, even just your scrolling or what you put in your cart, and they're collecting all that information and creating profiles about each of us to be used in mostly in the digital marketing space. It's a very vast and complicated marketplace, but that's generally what they're doing. They're vacuuming up as much information from all of our online activity and creating profiles about each of us in order to sell and or, but if that information gets in the wrong hands, it can become very problematic.
Madam Chair, is it okay if I add something?
Yes,
and I would say they can really, the use of this information can be really pernicious. They're getting your like face now and everything. Like, they can create apps, the data brokers sell to folks who create apps, and someone can just take a picture of your face and identify who you are. They can say where you live. You know, you open up your weather app every morning and that tells you where you live. Like, weather apps are notorious for tracking you. Plus, you've got two bills on surveillance pricing coming up. That is an area where this data is used, right, to set up the highest price you will pay, essentially. So I think it's really important that consumers are on top of this, and I think we're up to about 20 states now that have this, bipartisan states. It's not a blue thing. It's not a red thing. All states are looking at this. And then I just wanted to address the representative's question about weaponizing the statute. We are really working with businesses to come into compliance, and as long as it's not willful noncompliance or real abuse of the data right now, we're still going to get them into compliance. That's all we want. It's much easier for us. There's so many violators out there. Get the companies into compliance. We're not trying to target anyone. We're trying to protect people. So,
Representative Falconer, and then we'll have Representative Elkins, and then Representative Dodseth, and then we do need to move on to the next bill for scheduling purposes.
Great, thank you. Just one quick follow-up comment, just that, yeah, I forget when or who said it, but I've often, kind of, as I'm teaching my kids, like, how to use apps, websites responsibly as well. The quote is something like, if an app is free, you are the product.
That's right.
And so I think it's really important for people to realize that these companies are making a lot of money off of our data, selling it to whoever wants to buy it for whatever purposes. And I would encourage everybody, yeah, if you don't want that to happen for your personal data, your face, as you said, take advantage of this. Thanks.
Representative Elkins.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just, we will continue to work on improving the law as well. So we've already heard a bill in this committee and passed it on to judiciary that would bring the protections of for the data that's collected from our apps and our devices more firmly within the law, defining it as sensitive data. We have a bill in the revisor's queue that would set up a regulatory regime for data brokers. And working with this team to on a technical cleanup bill to plug any of the issues that these guys are running into as they move to enforce the law.
Thank you. Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow-up question on your statement about willful. How do you determine what willful looks like?
Madam Chair. No, that's a great question, and that's what we do in sort of every investigation, and that's why we have subpoena power to sort of look at, to ask them questions, to look at documents. And usually it's like, you know, we know this is going on. You know, you find this sort of smoking gun email, or you get answers to the questions where you can see a pattern, right? It's not just, here's a company, they've tried their best. And that you can see, you know, going back and forth, looking how to comply with the law. But there's something more there in the investigation.
Representative Dudley, thank you. Seeing no further discussion or questions from the committee, thank you so much for the presentation. And we will now move on to our first bill for the day. So up next is House File 3408, Representative Chair Katisa Watoon. All right, so our first, if you'd like to go ahead and move your bill in front of the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 3408 be before the committee and then laid over for a possible committee discussion. And
wonderful. All right, and I see that there is a one amendment. Can you move the amendment and please explain it?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I do have an A1 author's amendment. This changes the text of the bill slightly. As we all know, in the rush before session to get language into the revisor, occasionally there are things that are left out of the text. And so upon further review of the bill, we determined that the bill was only, the language as introduced was only applying to brick and mortar grocery stores. And that was not my original intention. We want to expand this so that it will include online grocers and third party organizations.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A1? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All aye. Right. Representative Katisa Watoon, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members. This morning, we are discussing a bit of an industry boogeyman that goes by many names: dynamic pricing, algorithmic pricing, surveillance pricing. But does a rose by any other name still smell as sweet? Consumers are spending more than ever on groceries for many reasons, including tariffs, inflation, even corporate price gouging disguised as inflation. Prices are up and profits are up. And Minnesotans deserve for us to step in and ensure that companies are not acting with impunity, gobbling up all of our personal data in order to use that to charge us more at the checkout. Today, I invite you to join me to protect Minnesotans and stop surveillance price gouging. Over the past year, we've gotten access to multiple studies that have been done in this space. Consumer Reports has released one most recently, and even the FTC have done deep dives into the behavior of corporations to track users across websites, apps, geographic locations, and more, and use this data to estimate consumer income, urgency of purchase, and potential other alternatives that they may have when they're considering a purchase. The legislature did act on emergency price gouging back in 2023, but this practice has grown with the widespread implementation of artificial intelligence, or AI, meaning that this technology could soon be coming to a grocery store near you. As we look back at the past 2 to 3 decades, we see that legislation and regulation is often playing catch-up with technology. And in this committee, we've had myriad discussions about unregulated technological growth and how it has harmed consumers. Social media impeding the mental health of young people, the nudification technology that Representative Hansen just educated us about a couple weeks ago, and so much more. So the Stop Grocery Surveillance Price Gouging Act will help protect Minnesotans' personal data by prohibiting retail grocers, both physical and virtual, from setting individual prices based on consumer information. The bill also outlines what is not surveillance pricing and includes a narrow exception for discounts that are available to certain groups, veterans, seniors, et cetera, and loyalty programming. House File 3408 does also require the usage of facial recognition technology in stores and restricts the usage of electronic shelf labels to a 24-hour price change timeline. So that's not an all-out ban on electronic shelf labels. And Madam Chair, I've engaged in initial discussions with numerous stakeholders, including the Retailers Association, the grocers, the Farmers Union, and these conversations will continue. I'm actually setting up an in-person visit to a grocery store in my district to better understand the pricing process, and would welcome any members who would like to learn more about this and how we can take action now to prevent future harms to Minnesotans.
Thank you so much. We will now proceed to public testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record. First up is Justin Stoferon. Did I get it?
Yes.
And then on deck is Steve Barthel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, committee members. Excuse me, I'm sorry. My name is Justin Stoferon with Minnesota Farmers Union. We're a grassroots organization that's represented family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities since 1918. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of efforts to limit surveillance pricing in grocery. Since January 2020, grocery prices in Minnesota have risen over 30%. But those that grow our food are not seeing a windfall. Farmers today receive less than 16 cents for every dollar we spend on food. This disconnect is in part because of the extreme consolidation in our food system. A recent analysis by economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta found retail consolidation was the key driver of higher food inflation among metro regions. Yet the grocery sector has become dominated by an ever-shrinking number of players. According to data from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, while independent grocers used to account for nearly half of grocery sales, today the four largest grocery chains scoop up nearly 60% of sales. In Minnesota, according to ILSR, 37% of Minnesota's grocery stores are the largest retailers, such as Walmart or Target. Behind this change are unfair pricing practices that have undermined small businesses and driven up costs. Consider a recent federal antitrust complaint that detailed the ways in which Walmart used Pepsi to set an artificially high price floor for soft drinks, while then also pressuring Pepsi to raise costs on its competitors whenever those prices got too close to Walmart's. Now enter the looming prospect of surveillance pricing and what it could mean for high grocery costs. You'll be hearing later today from Consumer Reports about its investigation into Instacart's surveillance pricing practices, but it included an experiment in a St. Paul Target where, despite purchasing the same items, shoppers fell into one of seven price categories ranging from $81.24 to $86.78. Following that investigation, the Trump administration's Federal Trade Commission said, quote, like so many Americans, we are disturbed by what we've read in the press about Instacart's alleged pricing practices. Not only could surveillance pricing mean opaque and rising prices for individuals, it could also create a more unlevel playing field. One e-commerce platform highlighted AI agents' ability to decide where to shop and what brands to purchase, opening up a future where surveillance pricing will create walled gardens where big tech firms use advertising spend and platform fees to squeeze out smaller competitors. While we recognize this legislation, although I think the amendment gets in that direction, needs tweaks in order to fully address the issues I've outlined today, we look forward to working with Representative Katisa Watoon, appreciate her leadership, and look forward to working with committee members to protect fair pricing and fair markets. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next up, Steve Barthel, followed by Jessica Verito.
He got the trick chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Cagle and Chair O'Driscoll and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bartle. I am Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Grocers Association. For more than 125 years, the MGA has been proud to serve as the leading voice for Minnesota's food industry. Today, our membership includes more than 250 companies, including many of the multi-generational and locally owned retailers that Minnesotans have come to recognize as trusted household names. We appreciate Representative Katisa Watoon for taking the time to speak to some of our members last week during our day on the Hill about this proposal and some of our concerns, particularly with the changes to the electronic shelf labels. And as she mentioned, we are scheduling a tour of a local store in Eden Prairie. Would welcome any other members of this committee to either that meeting or to one in your own district to show you how a grocery store's pricing system operates and why. And we think that that background on how that pricing works would help kind of ground this discussion on the operational realities of running a store and clarify why this type of surveillance pricing described in this bill is not a practice among our retailers. At a high level, the price displayed on the shelf, whether on a paper tag or an electronic shelf label, is connected to a single store-wide pricing database. And when an item is scanned at checkout, the system simply pulls that price from that centralized database. To engage in the type of surveillance pricing and real-time individualized price changes contemplated in House File 3408, that would require a far more complex system in which every customer has a unique pricing database. Simply put, our members do not have the capability, budget, or desire to engage in such practices. Community grocers sponsor local organizations and festivals, support youth sports teams, and donate millions of meals to food shelves every year to help their neighbors. They do all this while operating on a slim margin of 1.5 to 2%, selling products that mostly range from $2 to $6. Their focus is on serving and winning their customers by delivering quality products, offering them at competitive prices, and providing an exceptional customer service, not by squeezing extra nickels and dimes from their customers through pricing gimmicks. At the same time, independent retailers face significant challenges. Continued market consolidation and competition from dominant national chains like Walmart and Amazon, steeply rising labor rates and costly state mandates, tariffs, mounting property taxes, growing energy prices, and increasing levels of theft, all of which are outside of their control. Retailers are constantly seeking operational efficiencies to mitigate these growing costs. Electronic shelf labels are one such tool. There's nothing nefarious about ESL technology. It is simply a more efficient, environmentally friendly, and accurate method for displaying prices. ESLs eliminate the need to manually print and replace paper tags, a major task in stores that average more than 32,000 items, and significantly reduce the staff time required to do routine pricing updates. We do not believe the legislature should be restricting ESL technology in an effort to prevent a practice, mainly surveillance pricing in brick-and-mortar grocery stores, that is not occurring. Again, thank you to Representative Katisa Watoon and to the committee for your time. The invitation remains open for anyone who would like to come to a store in their local area to learn more about the operation, the challenges, and how these pricing systems work. So thank you very much.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind, Representative Hewitt, did you have a question to this testifier?
I will later, but we can keep going.
All right, thank you. Next up, Jessica Verito. I hope I'm saying that right.
My Italian family would be. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Vittorio, and I serve as Senior Vice President for Legal Risk and Compliance for Vision Group, Inc., based in Dallas, Texas. Our America's headquarters is in Dallas, Texas. We are a global retail technology company, and most notably, we produce ESL systems. So I am here. I have some concerns about the language in the bill at issue here, specifically the prohibition on ESLs, but really I think this is a good opportunity to provide some technical context on how modern retail pricing systems work and most critically how they don't work. We've seen this in a lot of places throughout the country, and we've heard this in other places in the hearing today. There's a call both from your constituents and around the country to ensure that pricing is transparent and fair, and that's a practice that we've worked really hard in the background to ensure that our products help support. And we've worked with a lot of organizations to do that, so I'm excited to share some of that information with y'all. First, I think it's important to recognize that retail pricing technology, specifically ESLs, are not surveillance technology. ESLs provide information and improve how pricing is displayed, but they do not use cameras, facial recognition, or biometric identifiers. They do not ingest personal information, personal data, or demographic information. The prices that displayed are uniform for all customers, just as they are with paper labels. Additionally, surge pricing is not a feature of retail pricing technology. Retail prices are typically set in advance, often days and weeks ahead, based on inventory cycles, supplier contracts, and promotional calendars. Prices change infrequently, not dynamically, and ESLs were technically and functionally designed with those pricing cycles in mind, not the ones contemplated by surge pricing cycles. A 2025 study conducted by a variety of researchers from a handful of independent academic organizations examined more than 380 million grocery transactions across more than 100 stores and found no statistically or economically meaningful increase in temporary price increases following the adoption of ESLs. That study was completed in mid to late 2025. I always think it's important to note whenever a technology company gets up here, oftentimes you'll see them through a trade association. Our industry does not have a trade association. We don't coordinate studies like this in the background. I work for the company directly. So we're not engaged in a process of trying to convince retailers, regulators, or the industry that we're not doing something that we are in fact doing. In addition to that, as I mentioned, we work really heavily with regulators and with regulatory bodies. Federal technical standards recognize ESLs as a compliant and consumer-friendly pricing tool. In 2025, the National Institute of Standards and Technology published its unit pricing guide, which explicitly recognizes in the best practices section ESLs as an acceptable and recommended method for displaying unit pricing when implemented properly. This guidance was developed in a multi-year process with input from state regulators and consumer advocacy organizations, including Consumer Reports, who I believe you'll hear from later today. I know that there's some concerns from some labor organizations related to retail pricing technology and the reduction or displacement of workers, but I think it's important to recognize when we talk about pricing, there's a variety of systems at play here. The ESL, where you're going to see the price displayed, is not the same system as your point of sale system at a store. It's also not the same system as your pricing database system. And those systems are not owned by the same companies. They're not owned by subsidiaries of the same companies. The companies that produce the point of sale systems are completely separate from, my company, for example. So I know that there's been some concern about automation of jobs, but the ESLs do not automate core retail jobs. They replace a single manual task, repeatedly printing, cutting, and taping paper price tags. And in practice, what we've seen is that retailers adopting digital pricing technology have employees spending less time on ladders, changing tags, and more time assisting customers on the floor and mostly picking e-commerce orders. I commend the bill author because there's a lot of important questions to be raised here about how data is being used in automatic decision making. But ESL systems, as currently used in Minnesota, are not an example of the harmful and predatory practices that are contemplated. We do not surveil customers. We don't personalize prices. We're not encouraging surge pricing. So I'm happy to answer any technical questions that y'all have and happy to be a resource to the bill's sponsor and the committee.
Thank you. Next up is Will Hagen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the testimony and please state your name for the record.
I should have learned from Steve on that.
Right, there you go.
Chairs Cagle and O'Driscoll and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify and thank you to Representatives Katiza Watun and Greenman for the ongoing conversations on the bills. I'll be combining my testimony on both bills for the sake of the committee's time today. My name is Will Hagen and I represent Minnesota retailers. Our members range from small, locally owned stores to regional and national operators serving customers across the state. No matter the size, they share one thing in common. They compete every day to earn the next customer visit. At the core of retail is a simple truth. Success depends on offering the best value, not the highest price. Retailers do not win by charging more. They win by staying competitive. And in today's environment, that competition is intense. Today's consumers can compare prices instantly and switch stores easily. That constant competitive pressure disciplines pricing in real time. If a retailer prices too high, customers leave, sometimes permanently. And that way, competition itself is one of the strongest protections for consumer affordability. Retailers use pricing tools and digital systems for one purpose, to remain competitive and deliver value. Importantly, these tools are not limited to large companies. Local retailers across Minnesota use digital pricing tools to respond to changing supplier costs, managing inventory, reducing pricing errors, and offering promotions. The retail environment today is also dynamic. Retailers are navigating rapid cost shifts driven by supply chains, global markets, and tariff changes. Costs can change quickly, and retailers must adapt quickly as well. Digital pricing systems allow retailers to respond efficiently, help control costs, and maintain affordable prices at the shelf. Economic research supports this. Studies on dynamic pricing have found it can increase overall consumer welfare by expanding access to lower prices at certain times and improving product availability. In many cases, both businesses and consumers benefit. Retailers support the principle that consumer data should not be used to unfairly raise prices. This is a reasonable concern. However, we are concerned that these bills go much further and could limit retailers' ability to use data to lower prices and provide savings. For example, many retailers offer personalized coupons based on purchase history through voluntary opt-in loyalty programs. Consumers choose to enroll because they want discounts. These programs are designed to deliver savings, not increase prices. Under the broad definitions of these bills, some of the consumer savings tools could fall into legal gray areas. Turning specifically to HF 3408, the bill focuses on retail food stores, but reaches deeply into store-level operations. Electronic shelf labels are not about surveillance pricing. They improve pricing accuracy, reduce errors, and allow retailers to respond quickly to changing supplier costs. They also enable same-day markdowns, which are especially important for food approaching its sell-by date. Restrictions that slow responsiveness or increase labor costs ultimately put upward pressure on prices. HF 3794 goes further. It applies broadly to automated decision systems and extends it to workforce management by defining wage to include scheduling, task assignments, and incentive structures. Retail workforce systems are designed to align staffing with customer demand and ensure stores operate efficiently. Regulating those systems under a surveillance pricing framework creates significant complexity and uncertainty. It's also worth noting that we don't believe any other state has enacted a law with this level of scope regulating both pricing and wages in this way. These bills should also be considered alongside Minnesota's existing consumer data privacy law, which already establishes standards around data collection, consent, and use. Finally, the broader policy context matters. To date, there has not been a widely established pervasive surveillance-based pricing abuses in stores. I'll end by saying we support transparency, fairness, and protecting consumers. But affordability is driven by competition, efficiency, and the ability to adapt. We appreciate the goal of protecting consumers. However, the impacts of these bills should not unintentionally eliminate discounts, increase operational costs, or restrict tools that help retailers deliver savings to customers. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other testifiers or any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, I will move to... For this bill? Yes.
3408.
Please, if you'd like to come up to the rostrum, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Keagle and Chair O'Driscoll. Thank you for having me here. My name is Tara Hoops. I am representing the Chamber of Progress. We are a tech industry association that is supportive of technology's most progressive future. Thank you again for having us here. We agree at a time when the cost of living is the number one issue for Americans across the board. This bill asks Minnesota to ban speculative, unproven harms while putting real grocery savings at risk. Despite years of headlines about surveillance pricing, there is little evidence that grocery stores are using personal data to charge individual shoppers higher prices. This shouldn't be a surprise because grocery retail is intensely competitive. Across supermarkets, warehouse clubs, online delivery, neighborhood markets, grocers compete vigorously for every sale. A company that uses personal data to overcharge a customer is not being clever. It's just going to be sending a customer straight to another rival. What grocers actually do use data for is to compete harder for your business through loyalty rewards, targeted coupons, and personalized discounts. HF3408 would ban personalized savings.
Put the mic closer to your mouth. Thank you.
Sorry.
You're good.
It would ban these personalized savings that Minnesota families already use and depend on. A parent who regularly buys children's cereals receives a discount when a new brand hits the shelves. A customer starts buying diapers and formulas, and the store sends targeted coupons on baby essentials. A delivery service notices you haven't ordered in weeks, sends a discount on your most purchased items. A grocer identifies shoppers who consistently buy store brand products and directs additional savings their way. These definitions are broad enough to prohibit every one of these practices. The bill defines personal information to include 14 categories of data, from purchase history and browsing activity to a catch-all covering a consumer's actions, habits, behaviors, and attributes. Any customized price based even partly on this data would violate the law. The bill does include exemptions for loyalty programs and group discounts, and those exemptions that exist are a bit telling. The drafters recognize that personalized deals can help consumers, but the conditions attached are so restrictive they would strip these discounts being offered uniformly to all qualifying customers. A grocer could no longer send a new parent a coupon on diapers because her purchase history shows she just had a baby. The store would have to offer that coupon to every loyalty member, regardless of whether they have children. If every promotion must be offered universally, many grocers would simply stop offering them. The result is not fair pricing, it is fewer discounts. Consumers are not passive in this exchange. 70% say they value loyalty programs. About 1 in 4 consumers earning under $40,000 a year choose their supermarket based on loyalty program memberships. Digital coupons save the average household $1,465 a year. At a time with tariffs hitting the prices for all goods, those dollars do matter to these families. These families who rely on these savings are mainly going to be low-income households, particularly those with children. These are people who would lose the most if this bill does pass. This bill also restricts ESLs that we have heard a lot from various testifiers in grocery stores, limiting price changes to once per day and requiring stores to maintain redundant paper tags for every item. But the largest peer-reviewed study of ESLs in U.S. grocery, analyzing over 100 million product-level observations across 114 stores, found that surge pricing was, quote-unquote, basically non-existent before ESLs, and it stayed non-existent with them. What ESLs do enable is more frequent markdowns on perishable goods nearing expiration, which research shows can reduce grocery food waste by up to 21%. Similar bills have been introduced across the country, and all of them have stalled or failed because legislators end up looking closely enough and all reach the same conclusion. You cannot ban algorithmic pricing without also banning everyday savings that families can count on. This bill asks Minnesota to be the first state in the country to ban grocery savings that families depend on, while the harm it targets remains unproven. I respectfully urge you to oppose HF 3408. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have some notes here I wanted to discuss real quick. But it's interesting to listen to the different testifiers today. And I don't know if this is a question more or if the representative could lay in on this. But what I've noticed even from the testimony today, this seems to be a group of people that don't even know they're in the room designing this outfit. It's basically, well, we'll take a little here, and a little here, and then we'll put together the software that does exactly what you're saying. And this frustrates me because I know it when one of the testifiers today said, Walmart sets the price. Well, Walmart sets the price, and that same price on Pepsi is what Rosemount Concessions is paying based on Walmart's pricing, so we get taken advantage of at a nonprofit sporting event. And so this affects us all across the board, and I really appreciate you carrying this bill. I mean, farmers only getting 16% of the take. This is Minnesota's economy is based on agriculture still. We really need to look at this. This is an up, and I got to tell you, I'm going to get a burner phone and basically take it to the grocery store with me now because I don't want anybody to know I'm there. So this is very concerning. Thank you, Representative, for carrying this bill. This is really important. We need to act.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Dodson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've got a quick question for the small-town grocer testifier that's here, if he could come up for a moment.
Oh, the Grocers Association. All right, Mr. Barthel, welcome back to the committee, or to the table.
Representative chose the other chair.
Oh, good call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question I would have is unexpected consequences that might happen through this. Do you foresee any potential discounts that may be eliminated to the consumer? I'll give you a brief scenario. Say if there's a order of Easter ham that's coming in and the retailer has an opportunity to actually move that product robustly quite quickly. Would this slow up that process to be able to post that and get that information out there to the consumers?
Mr. Barthel?
Madam Chair and Representative Dotseth, if a store had electronic shelf labels and were limited to only changing the price up to once a day and the price was set, then they would be restricted from updating that price later in the day, whether it's hams or bananas or whatever the item might be.
Representative Dotseth?
I think that pretty much answers my question. Just hearing that it may need some additional guardrails in place.
I have another question for you, Mr. Barthel. How often are grocers changing labels per day?
Right. Madam Chair, generally prices don't change very often, right? There are daily changes, there are weekly changes, right? Usually when you get your flyer in the mail, right? A lot of those are two-week windows, right? So the prices don't often change. But when they need to, it's for those perishable items or items that are trying to be moved more quickly. Generally speaking, though, price changes don't happen continually.
Right. So if you are trying to move an item quickly, does that price change, like, throughout the day? Or is it one day it's, you know, this price and, oh, it's getting a little bit closer, we better lower a couple more dollars? I'm just trying to get a sense of how often are the prices changing, because if we're allowing a 24-hour window and prices aren't changing, you know, within 2 weeks, just kind of curious about how requiring, you know, just that we have a baseline 24-hour pricing, I guess. How does that work practically?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it depends on the store specifically, but I don't think you would see, you know, like hourly price changes on an item, right, as you're getting closer to the end of the day and we need to get rid of these products. I don't think it's not that you're going to be seeing the price of an item change, you know, two, three, four times. Maybe there's a later in the day, right, maybe once as you get into the afternoon time, you could see it change.
Like the day old rules.
I don't think that's very common,
right.
But that is a scenario that could potentially be impacted. And if I may, just one comment about changing prices and if we're changing individually for customers, if right, the hypothetical where they're being tracked through the store, which I can tell you our members do not have the technology or the ability to do, the level of risk that runs for that retailer, put yourself in those shoes as a customer. If you see a price change, right, you're in the same aisle as another customer, and you see a price change while you're standing there, something tells me you're not going to be going back to that store. If you lose trust with that retailer, it's an extremely competitive market, and you will probably look to go somewhere else. So this concept of constantly changing prices for individuals, one, is something we're not able to do or interested in doing. Two, would be an extremely risky practice for an industry that's based on trust and consumer loyalty.
Right. Okay, so it sounds like we could probably work on that electronic pricing or shelf labels to figure out, you know, the best way to make it work for you guys so that Minnesota grocers have an advantage over some of these giant retailers that are undercutting our markets. You know, we want to see grocers in, you know, our grocers succeed. And so I know I've been out to the store with you guys, and I know the work you do. And so, like, we want to make sure that you guys are succeeding and that this is putting you on the same playing field as the giant conglomerates that can consolidate and set prices.
Yeah. So. Thank you, Madam Chair. And we will continue to work with Representative Katiza Watoon on this language and potential areas that we can work together.
Wonderful. Representative Dodseth, did you have, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative, for your bill and to the testifiers. I just want to make a quick technology comment here. We've heard a lot of people here saying that the thing that a lot of people are very concerned about isn't happening, right? We are assured that this is not happening, and we are going to talk about these electronic price tags in the future, and I think that we should. But I also just, it's important for us as lawmakers to recognize that, and I said this in judiciary yesterday, and I'll say it over and over again, it is our natural habitat as lawmakers to live in the blind spot way behind new technology. And once these new technologies are in place, we never catch them, right? We're seeing that with crypto, we're seeing that with AI, we see that with drones. Pick your technology, we're told it's not happening, we don't end up regulating it, and then we spend 10 years trying to catch up to technology that is out of control. So I would just want us to make sure that even if something is not happening now, we know what is happening. We know what direction things are moving in. We know that stores are starting to just not have price tags on their products. Right? The trend towards just not labeling how much something costs in the store is increasing. So I would like to make sure that we don't moderate the language of the bill such that we end up allowing something to happen because it's not happening now, because once it's out of the bottle, it's never going back in.
Thank you. We also do have another bill on the surveillance pricing, and so I think a lot of these questions can be bundled together, and I want to make sure that we get our testifiers in. So Representative Van Binsbergen.
There you go.
I got to just...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my question, I guess, really does go back to, well, first of all, I just want to thank the retailers out there and the small business owners. I have a concern how this is going to play out in our small communities. And the, you know, I'd like you to kind of address that and how you feel that taking place. And then, you know, I just really want to know about, can you give some specific examples of where there's really been harm done? Are we really, I don't see this happening in Minnesota, that individuals are getting charged a higher price. And can you just give a little more evidence of that?
Thank you, Representative. I know that we have somebody from Consumer Reports who actually did a study here in Minnesota, and so I think that question can be answered with the testifier coming up. But yeah, there are, and Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Van Binsbergen, for the question. That's exactly what they want you to think. Right? I mean, this is not just about, I see you rolling your eyes. I mean, some healthy skepticism is just fine when we are looking at preventing harm, right? But that is what the corporations want you to think. This isn't happening, or it's only happening once in a while, and it's not happening to people in my community until it is. And to Representative Finke's point, that is the pattern that the legislature and that Congress has followed when it comes to technology advancements for the last 20, 30, 40 years. You know, I mean, part of the reason why I'm carrying this bill, and it's not exactly applicable, but if any of you have seen the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise, that is what we're, you know, like, we're not talking about some of that same surveillance, like, creepiness. But he's walking through a mall, and he's walking past a Gap, and it scans his eyes, and it says, "When's the last time you treated yourself to a new pair of jeans, Representative Allen?" And it talks to him directly. And that's where, you know, it's like this sci-fi, futuristic, like, never going to happen. But of course, there's things happening today that we never thought were going to happen. I mean, look at Representative Hansen's nudification prevention bill. Like, did you ever imagine for a minute that there was, that you would be able to take a picture of somebody walking on the street and feed them into a thing and have them be naked? Is that something that you could have imagined 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago? I mean, that's what we're trying to do here, to prevent harm from happening. Every year, my family and I go camping. My husband grew up in Otter Tail County, so we visit the Battle Lake area. We visit Larry's Foods on a very regular basis. Part of this bill is to protect our local grocers because, like Representative Cagle was saying, the corporations that have money to invest in these technologies have an edge, right? They're doing this now. They have the access. Excuse me. They have the access. They have the finances to put it in place. As technology continues advancing and growing cheaper and more widespread, then potentially some of these retailers may have access to some of those changes. But at that point, is it too late for them to catch up? And so when we look at banning these practices, it means that the stores who aren't doing it then can more easily compete with the stores who are trying to take advantage of consumers. And that's, I guess, the way that I look at this legislation and the good that we can do together to prevent those future harms if they're not happening now.
Thank you, Representative Katisa-Watoon. And I think, you know, that's one of the things, you see the Dollar General or the Walmart move into town, and it's almost guaranteed that the local grocery store and hardware store is going to close. We do have another bill. I'm sorry. I know I have Representative Elkins, Allen, and Heintzman on. Can we do the next bill? And these do tie together, so a lot of the same questions. You're good, Representative Allen?
Yep.
You're good? Representative Heintzman, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have to address something because I think it needs to be pointed out. Representative Katisa-Watoon, you're getting negative reactions because the question was asking for a specific example. When Representative Van Binsbergen is asking, can you give me those examples? It's not in any nefarious way. It's, are we reacting to a hypothetical, or is the bill being drafted based on real-life examples that you can cite here today in committee? So please don't take it as somehow disrespectful in that sense. It's, we really need to know if there is something that you have identified as the bill author, please present it so that we can have the same information that you do and we can all make an educated choice based on that information.
Thank Representative Heintzman, thank you for that. And if you go to your packet, and I know this was emailed out, but there is the Consumer Reports article, and they did show pricing at a St. Paul Target where somebody was online and then walked into the store and there was a huge difference. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's fine. But Representative Van Binsbergen was asking the bill author. And that's, I think, fair for the bill author to then respond to the question. That's all.
Thank you. All right. With that, we will move on to, Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a couple of kind of maybe yes, no, or kind of process questions for the bill author. Representative Katisa-Watoon, if we have a provision here that says that prices can be changed once daily, is there a formula that's contemplating that? And I'll kind of set the scenario. Grocery store closes at 10 o'clock on Tuesday night. They open up again at 8 o'clock on Wednesday, and they make a decision from their 10 o'clock closing price to an 8 o'clock open price. What prevents others from getting in, and I'll use the term game the system, where they go into store A that opens at 8, but they don't open until 10 o'clock and set their prices for the day that are lower and consistently do that when the other competitor can't change prices if they only have once a day because someone came and shopped them and changed their prices later in the day? Does your bill contemplate any preventing of gamesmanship on that?
Representative Cutizo Toon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. Not at this point in time. So I would definitely be willing to explore with you and with the Grocers Association if there is further specification that we want to put in regarding that 24-hour window. But I think that's a very interesting thought.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cutizo Toon, for that. The other kind of sidecar question on that would be, your bill doesn't contemplate a retailer who can't change their price for the day for whatever reason because they've already done it or whatever, from removing the product from sale from the shelf until such time that they can adjust the price because there might have been like a situation with, you know, oil price spikes or price of the day market and some of those kinds of things where there's a shortage coming in. Does it allow for the retailer to literally pull all products that people might want from the shelf because it can't affect the price?
Representative Cassidy Toon.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, thank you. We don't have any emergency language built in, but I could definitely see a place for that in the language. If there was some sort of error and the store had already made a change, that we could maybe allow a secondary change to be made if necessary in an emergent situation like that.
Thank you. And Representative Cutizo Toon, would you like to lay your renew your motion to lay House File 3408 as amended over?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much. Next up is Representative Greenman with House File 3794. And I will move House File 3794 to be laid before us. I also understand that there is an A4 amendment. I will move the A4 amendment. Representative Greenman, would you like to explain the amendment for us, please?
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back in Commerce. The A4 is an amendment that includes two things. One, it updates the language with feedback from the Attorney General's office and other stakeholders. And then it also includes a burden-shifting provision that reflects the fact that companies are in complete control of the information and data that consumers or workers would need in order to determine if this is happening. And so it's just a burden-shifting that allows that presumption and then companies to rebut the presumption with the data.
Thank you. All right. All those in favor of the A4, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. All right. Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to be back here in Commerce to protect consumers, small businesses, and competitive markets from this predatory pricing, surveillance price discrimination. So what is surveillance price discrimination? And I heard questions for examples. These are all real-world examples. So imagine you pull into a Target parking lot, and you order a TV that costs, let's say, $500. And that's $100 more than the exact same TV if you ordered that TV from your home, from your device. Or you order groceries on Instacart and learn that your neighbor ordered the same groceries right next door, and the same eggs and cereal are 13% less for them than for you. Or you go to a Starbucks, and you go to Starbucks a lot, so you sign up for a loyalty program thinking that it's about deals and discounts, only to learn because of a California disclosure law that you were actually offered less discounts, paying more, and your data was being shared with 64 other companies likely sold as a product. These are real-world examples of how companies are using your personal data and high-tech AI tools right now to personalize prices based on the personal data that they have been collecting on all of us. So how does this work? Companies have been gobbling up all the information about us, and I'm sure that this committee has been talking a lot about what we do, about how we behave, anything they can get their hands on. They're buying it, they're scraping it, and they are putting billions of dollars in investments in pricing, technology, and experiments to determine how much we all are willing to pay for something. And then they are setting a personal price for you accordingly. To be clear, this is not pricing based on market forces, supply and demand, the cost of value and creating the goods plus a little profit. This is about pricing based on you, tailored to find the maximum amount you will pay and then charge you for it. So if you're a big company and your business, you're in the business of generating revenue and making money, which is what companies are, this has appeal. You can increase your margins by charging some people more and making it very hard for customers to comparison shop on price to get the best deal. You've already invested significant amounts of money in collecting all sorts of information about your customers, and now you have the AI tool to determine how much they're willing to pay for something and offer the price to them. And the best part is, in most cases, because a lot of, right now we're talking about online, but we know it's going retail, the people you're offering these prices to don't actually know what prices are being offered to other customers. And your small business competitors, if you're the big guys, can't compete. They don't have all this information. They haven't been acquiring these other giant companies or the data companies. They are not using price clearinghouses. So they don't know or are able to compete either. You can make a lot more money with surveillance pricing than just charging prices based on market research. And this isn't hypothetical. We've heard a lot of the advocacy groups saying it's hypothetical. I just gave you three examples. There's a bunch of reports in your packet about how this is happening today. The biggest businesses in the world are investing hundreds of billions of dollars to scale up their surveillance price gouging schemes. And they're quietly integrating the strategy into online retail platforms, but as Google announced, to AI chatbots too. This is a game changer for them. They are calling it the pricing revolution. But this revolution is being driven by big tech, Wall Street middlemen, and the retail giants at the expense of public, consumers, and small businesses. And the reason they're keeping it quiet is because consumers hate it. 84% of Americans said that they are concerned by AI-driven price gouging. It's just creepy. They're hoarding all this information on us. There's a black box that controls the prices, and they're giving us different prices than our neighbors. That just isn't fair. And so, while these companies aren't telling regulators, they're not coming and telling us what they're doing, they're not telling the public, they have been bragging about this to their investors and to the corporate middlemen that are helping them do this. Corporate CEO consultant McKinsey said of surveillance pricing, it can enhance pricing to generate 2 to 7 percentage points on sustained margin improvements. Listen to these investor calls. They're talking about why they're investing billions of dollars in this. Long story short, it's time to act before the price revolution leaves big tech in charge of prices and Minnesota consumers with less power and paying higher prices. That's why we need this bill. So what this bill does is it bans the practice of surveillance-based pricing and wage discrimination, which is defined as automated decision-making to inform individual prices and wages, which is just the price of labor, based on surveillance data regarding the consumer workers. It requires companies that are using this automated data to tell customers and the public about it. And the amendment I explained adds this burden shifting. What this bill does not do, it does not prevent companies from offering discounts to consumers based on supply and demand and market forces unrelated to people's individual personalized behavior. It does not prevent companies from offering discounts to common groups of people, to veterans and students and teachers that are clearly and conspicuously offered. If you want to offer a discount, people should hear about it and know about it. And that's available to everyone in the group. And it doesn't prevent offering discounts and memberships to customers that isn't individualized based on data they scraped and bought about you. So the real question is, why would we let these tech giants, these retail companies, spy on us and then use it to charge us more than our neighbors and to set prices? This is our chance. And as I heard in the last bill, the reason we need to act now is because it hasn't taken over our entire economy, but it is coming, and it is here online. And so now is the time to act to put some power back in the hands of Minnesota consumers and our small businesses. Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we have some testifiers.
Thank you very much. First up on our list is Justin Stoferon, followed by Angela Schwiznettel. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee again. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Cable. Chair O'Driscoll, for the record, I'm Justin Stofron at the Minnesota Farmers Union. I promise I won't totally repeat myself. I mentioned earlier that Farmers Union dates back to 1918, and our founding was part of farmers' efforts to ensure they received a fair price for what they produced. The fight for fair pricing dates back even further, though, to the 1870s, when farmers pushed for the Granger Laws that were in part an effort to curb the personalized and discriminatory prices from railroads. That same era produced the price tag, establishing the uniform pricing consumers have come to expect, and that's key to a fair and democratic economy. Polling from the economic think tank Groundwork Collaborative finds that 83% of Americans believe that businesses should charge all customers the same price for the same item. Surveillance pricing threatens to undermine fairness by using opaque and predatory pricing strategies that undermine consumer liberty and price transparency, leading to higher costs on Minnesota families. Today presents an opportunity for the legislature to get out ahead of an anti-competitive practice that will thrive in what writer Cory Doctorow calls the, quote, vast underground empire of non-consensual data harvesting. Some surveillance pricing companies have boasted about their ability to predict things like when you'll get paid, suggesting a future where payday will also mean higher prices. Earlier this year, Google announced its move to integrate its AI platform, Gemini, into retail, including a service called Direct Offers, where businesses will pay to allow Google to set prices when it makes recommendations. It's not hard to see how a monopolist like Google, with its dominance over search and advertising, could turn this into a system of kickbacks and tacit collusion to the detriment of consumers and independent businesses. While we've focused on consumers, powerful seed companies and fertilizer suppliers and other companies in agriculture are already squeezing farmers, what might they do with an AI price setting tool? All of this serves to create a marketplace where there are no true prices. And to the discussion about discounts here today, that's also going to, if we don't know the true price of things, how do you know if you're getting a discount? In competitive markets, surveillance pricing would not be nearly as attractive a strategy, but in consolidated markets, this is a powerful mechanism for gouging buyers. Unfortunately, 3/4 of industries have become more consolidated since the 90s. The economy as a whole has grown 50% more consolidated since 2005. And at the current rate of consolidation, it's estimated by 2070, we'll have just one company per industry. As legislators discuss the issue of affordability, cracking down on surveillance pricing is a way to help address one of the root causes of our affordability crisis, the unfair pricing strategies being employed across the economy. I want to thank Representative Greenman for leadership on this issue, and MFU looks forward to working with members on this committee to create a fairer and more democratic economy that works for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next up, Angela Schweiznettel. And then after that, we have Grace Geedy on Zoom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Hi, my name is Angela Schweiznettel. I own Moon Palace Books, a neighborhood bookstore in South Minneapolis. We opened in 2012, and one of the things I've worked really hard on since we opened was our website. Bookstores have the reputation of being a little old-fashioned, a little bit anti-tech, so it was really important to me to have a functional website that people could use to order books. And we work really hard to have all of our inventory up live on our website so that when people are shopping at 3 a.m., they can see exactly what we have in stock and what we don't. When they call and say, your website says you have 3 copies, I can say, if our website says we have 3 copies, we have 3 copies. There are a couple of changes we've seen recently in book selling. We've always had trouble with people coming in and looking for books that we're unable to order for them because they're published only on Amazon and are only available through them or through their exclusive ebook format. But lately, we've had people coming in looking for books that simply do not exist and have been made up by AI. Sometimes it's a book by their favorite author that they think they've somehow missed, and sometimes it's been recommended to them from ChatGPT or some other AI-written article that after much searching, it turns out that the title and the author have simply been made up. The other thing that happens is when we have a book like our best-selling nonfiction title, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald, that is currently only available in hardcover, and our customers, who like most people are price conscious, are searching for the book in a cheaper paper book format. When I search Gales of November paperback on Amazon, my top three results are books with the same title and similar covers, but with different authors that are using AI to publish a book that looks exactly like the book that everyone wants to read, but isn't. Now, if what you're into are shipwrecks, and you come into my store, and we are happy to sell you a book and recommend a book about shipwrecks, but what we won't do is charge you more because you like books on shipwrecks for those same books than other customers. And when my customers search for a book on our website, everybody gets the same result with a price that doesn't change depending on who they are, what data they may or may not have agreed to share. When they're searching for the same book on a retailer like Amazon, they may be getting different results and prices depending on who they are and how much the algorithm thinks it can get them to pay. They might get a cheaper result the first time they buy something, and then they always think they're going to get a better deal from that vendor, even if the algorithm has figured out that based on where they live or what their credit score is or some other mysterious combination of data, they're shown a higher price. I don't want my customers to be shown a cheaper price because they've stopped in my store to price compare or looked at my website. I don't want them to be shown a higher price than their neighbor who hasn't come to my store or checked out my website. I don't want that as a consumer, and I don't want that for my customers, for my competition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up is Grace Geehy, and she's on Zoom. If you could just introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Cagle, Rep. Johnson, and honorable members of the committee. My name is Grace Geehy, and I'm a policy analyst at Consumer Reports, where I focus on consumer protection issues in artificial intelligence policy. Consumer Reports is well known for testing vacuums, cars, everything, putting out a magazine. We're a nonpartisan nonprofit with 6 million members across the US, and we also do consumer protection advocacy. I'm here to urge an aye vote on HF 3794. Surveillance pricing is an affordability issue and an enormous source of frustration for consumers, which I know because we asked our members about it and we got an outpouring of responses. So one member, for example, told us about their practice of clearing their browser history while searching for flights and seeing the prices change. Another member shared their experience of shopping online for an electric razor, seeing a discount code, then looking at a more expensive razor, and then navigating back to the original razor only to find that the discount was now gone. Another member shared that when they use a VPN and change their location, the IP address that kind of tells other websites where you are in the country, they saw lower prices for flights. Consumers shouldn't have to be playing these games. They shouldn't have to use a VPN to pretend they're in a different city just to figure out if they're being played. They shouldn't be worried that if they check out a more expensive product, it'll impact the price of other products they see. And these are their lived experiences, but they're examples borne out by investigative journalism too. So one example, an investigative journalist writing for the outlet San Francisco Gate, SF Gate, did this controlled experiment where they looked at prices offered for a specific hotel room in Manhattan on a specific date, and then varied his system, browser, cookies, location, that's his computer's IP address. And when he found that when he changed his IP address from the Bay Area to locations like Phoenix or Kansas City, the prices for that exact same hotel room on the same night dropped by more than $200 per night in one instance and more than $500 per night in another instance. I've submitted some written testimony that includes several other examples of surveillance pricing, along with some suggestions CR has to ensure the bill works well for consumers and the marketplace writ large. And I just want to address the discount issue as well, because I know it's already come up today and I suspect it'll continue to come up in conversation. This bill already has a really thoughtful exemption for these kind of commonly understood group discounts that are kind of tied in some ways to people's personal data, right? So they need to be addressed in the bill. That's, you know, your veteran discount, your senior discount, what have you. There's one more narrowly crafted discount exemption we would suggest adding, and I'm happy to talk more about that issue. It's something we've given a lot of thought to, though, because, you know, discounts based on personal data, people's click rates, demographics, search history, inferences about their income, these do need a bit of sunlight for these do need a bit of sunlight because we can't live in a world where the prices that people ultimately pay after discounts are secret. And you know, there's evidence of some pretty creepy, honestly, profiling happening in the world of discounts. So happy to speak more to that, but I know we've got a lot of folks trying to testify and you're hearing, trying to hear a lot of bills today. So I appreciate the time.
Thank you. And if you could just stay on Zoom if there's any questions from members. Next up, we have Jenny Hill, followed by Jonathan Cotter. If you could please come to Jenny Hill is online. If you could please just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you, chairs and committee members. My name is Jenny Hill, and I'm the owner of Avant Garden, a coffee shop and independent bookstore in downtown Anoka. I appreciate the opportunity to testify to the committee today about the challenges I face as a small business owner and what surveillance pricing could mean for my business and our customers. Avant Garden is a community staple in Anoka. We are passionate about building civic engagement by hosting ongoing events and establishing partnerships with trusted organizations to raise awareness and donations for mutual aid. We are currently preparing to sponsor the Anoka County Library Summer Reading Challenge. Last summer was our first time with this sponsorship, and this resulted in over 1,000 donations to reading participants, adults and children. This year, we anticipate even more. We do this work not because we are independently wealthy, but because we see the benefits firsthand of an established reading culture and what that brings to our community. We have built a strong sense of goodwill due to our outreach. However, we experience the inability to compete with big box stores and online retailers. Every day we encounter readers who are delighted to find our store and enjoy the browsing experience and exposure to titles they likely would not have discovered if it were not for us. It is very common to have an in-depth conversation about their discovery in hopes they will buy the book from us and support our business, only to have them take a picture of it instead and find it available for sometimes less than cost on Amazon. This scenario in itself is an impossible one to compete with, and I can't imagine what surveillance pricing would do for us in our community. In conclusion, I hope this committee will take action to put meaningful guardrails around the practice of surveillance pricing and help ensure a level playing field for small businesses and their customers. I want to thank Representative Greenman for her leadership on this issue and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, Jonathan Cotter, followed by Nina DeSalvo. That chair. Welcome to the committee.
Should have learned from the last bill, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you. Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Cotter, Director of Healthcare and Commerce Policy with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. On behalf of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and our 6,300 member businesses across the state, we appreciate the intent behind this proposal. Consumers and workers should be treated fairly in the marketplace. However, we have significant concerns with House File 3794 as amended. The bill regulates what it defines as surveillance data, automatic decision systems, and surveillance price discrimination, terms broad enough to encompass routine behavioral and transactional information used in business analytics. Across retail, hospitality, logistics, manufacturing and technology sectors, employers rely on automated tools to manage inventory, prevent fraud, administer loyalty programs, respond to demand, and structure compensation systems. These are foundational components of modern commerce and often lower cost to consumers. Although the bill contains exclusions for cost-based pricing, public discounts, insurance risk data, and federally regulated credit decisions, the boundaries between prohibited conduct and those exclusions may be difficult to apply in practice. For example, the bill allows price differences based on differences in cost incurred to provide a good or service, but it may be challenging for employers to determine what types of data inputs or operational factors qualify under that standard. While While the bill includes definitions and exclusions, businesses may still struggle to determine how those provisions apply to common pricing and compensation tools used in modern business operations. That ambiguity creates meaningful compliance risk. Employers would be forced to self-interpret complex definitions with potential enforcement consequences. Regulatory uncertainty increases legal exposure, slows innovation, and discourages investment. Beyond just the pricing of goods, this bill similarly oversteps into the management of workplaces directly, seeking to impose new regulatory frameworks addressing what the bill characterizes as surveillance-based wage discrimination. Following recent substantial changes in the workplace regulatory environment over the past 3 years, employers need to have the autonomy to make staffing decisions and provide wages, benefits, and schedules that are appropriate for their workplace and responsive to workplace needs. Workplaces in Minnesota already are heavily regulated. The chamber continues to oppose the increasing number of workplace mandates by the legislature to interfere with this dynamic. For these reasons, we cannot support House File 3794 as drafted. Thank you for your consideration of our position.
Thank you. Next up is Nina DeSalvo. Nina? Going once?
Should be on one.
No. All right, I don't see Nina. Is there any members of the public wishing to testify? Please go up, and if you could please make your remarks short, we would like to move to member discussion, so thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, members of the committee, for having me here. My name is Tara Hoops. I am with the Chamber of Progress, as mentioned, a tech industry association that works to ensure all people benefit from technological advances. I am here to respectfully urge you to oppose HF 3794. At a time when the cost of living is the number one issue facing American families, this bill asks Minnesota to ban speculative, unproven harms while putting real consumer savings at risk. Despite years of headlines about surveillance pricing, there is no comprehensive evidence that consumers are being systematically harmed by personalized pricing. This shouldn't be a surprise because, as I mentioned before, retail is fiercely competitive. Consumers can compare prices instantly just from a click of a button. What companies actually use data for is to compete harder for your business. This bill would ban the personalized savings that Minnesota families already use and depend on. For example, your grocery store could send you a coupon on the cereal your kids eat every week. Your local coffee shop can send you a discount because you haven't visited in a while. A streaming service offers you a lower rate to come back after you have canceled. A small brand tries to build a following by offering a targeted deal to shoppers most likely to be interested. These definitions are so broad that they sweep in virtually all of these practices. Any data a business collects from purchase history to location to browsing activity counts as surveillance data. Any software that helps inform a price qualifies as automated decision system. The result is that everyday discounts, targeted promotions, and loyalty rewards all fall on the wrong side of the ban. The bill's narrow exemptions do not solve the problem. There is no exemption for loyalty program, even though 70% of consumers say they value them, and many of lower-income households rely on them when choosing where to shop. Consumers, as I mentioned, are not passive in this exchange. 91% say that they are willing to share this data in exchange for discounts and rewards, and the families who rely on them need them the most. As I mentioned, digital coupons alone can save households more than $1,400 a year. Beyond the pricing ban, this bill imposes disclosures and dispute requirements on any business using an automated decision system for pricing, and the bill's definition captures any software that assists a pricing decision. A restaurant owner using a pricing tool, a retailer using inventory management software, a small business owner even using a spreadsheet, all would be required to publish data accuracy procedures, respond to individual consumer inquiries for how their prices are set, and create formal dispute processes. The cost for larger businesses, of course, would be substantial here, even with a dedicated team of legal services. But for small businesses, that burden is going to be prohibitive. As I mentioned before, many bills have popped up around the country on this, and they have either stalled or failed because many people do come to the conclusion you cannot ban these types of algorithmic pricing without also medical banning, the everyday savings that families count on. The alleged harm is speculative. The consumer savings are not, and that is why I respectfully urge you to oppose. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And moving, we will be moving to member discussion now. So one of the reasons that this bill was attractive to me is because of, you know, our society is based on capitalism, and for capitalism, we need free markets, we need competitiveness, and we need transparency. And I really see, you know, this price setting or the surveillance pricing really enables us to, or enables companies to hide the prices. You know, they're extracting more wealth from the middle class. They're, you know, it's rewarding data monopolies instead of competition, allowing algorithmic collusion, discriminatory pricing, and number one, just eroding trusts in the market. And so I'm really happy that you brought this bill. Representative Elkins, I have you on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of observations. I think earlier we heard testimony from the grocers about the constraints of the way prices are maintained, and I think most of the cases that really resonate are pretty much limited to e-commerce examples. So a newer e-commerce business would have all new technology systems, none of the constraints that legacy brick-and-mortar businesses would have. And almost all of the really egregious examples we're seeing here seem to be limited to e-commerce. And I would just, you know, urge us to keep that in mind. So I think we're laying both of these bills over. Reading through I would encourage members to read the Consumer Reports letter. I think it's got some really good constructive suggestions in it as well. But I'm glad we're taking this on now and kind of getting ahead of the curve, because it may not be that serious a problem yet, but it clearly is emerging as a serious problem that's worthy of our close study.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Allen, I had you on the list from last time. No? Okay. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. I can't fathom being against this bill. I think this is a pretty fundamental American Minnesotan value. I would challenge anyone to go find two Minnesotans, go to a store, buy a package of diapers, and then compare, and one paid $11 and one paid $13. At a very basic level, those two Minnesotans are going to say, that's not fair. It's not going to sit well with them. Then imagine that you tell them the reason for that different price is because the social media accounts you've been on, some of the websites you use, have been selling your data to that store. Or last week you saved 12 cents on your dozen eggs and joined their loyalty program, but you unbeknown to yourself gave access to that store to your browsing history. And so now they know exactly what you will pay and will raise your prices based on that. Whether you got the lower price or the higher price, those two Minnesotans are going to say, that's wrong. We don't want that to be a part of our economy and our society. That's what this bill does. Surveillance pricing is ceding more and more control to corporations, to the corporate class. Many of them are owned and operated by members of the Epstein class. And they are continually wanting more control over every single moment in our lives. And for too long, for decades, we as policymakers have ceded their ability to control how much money goes into the pockets of Minnesotans through their wages. That's why wages are stagnating. Now, through technology, those same companies have figured out how to change the value of that dollar in your pocket when you're at the store. How much money, your hard-earned money, buys your family. That is wrong. It is not a conservative or progressive ideal. It is an American ideal that people should pay the same for the same product that they get in the same store, and that people should be able to plan their lives, their budgets, how much things cost, based on a fair market system. This is a great bill. I'm happy to support it. And we need to be active in this space. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Is there any other further discussion from the committee? Well, I just want to share, you know, I know Representative Heitzman was really concerned about if this is actually happening. And before session started, we did a little experiment. And my CA here has a twin, identical twin. And they live, they share, live in the same household. They're still together on their phone plans, you know, trying to cost save. And so we asked him and his brother to do a little experiment. And from their house, from their separate phones, they both ordered Ubers to the Mall of America. And Sam's here was consistently $9 more. And we could not figure out why. And one of the reasons we might think is because of the percentage of the battery. We've heard that a lot of these rideshare companies will surge price when your battery is super low. So because they know that, oh, crap, your phone's going to die. I need a ride now. And so we were able to do this experiment and saw the price differences, have the screenshots. We kept the receipts, so to say. And so this is happening. You know, the testifier from Consumer Reports, if you go on their TikTok, they have a video about the car seat in the Target in St. Paul, so they can show you right there that this is actually happening right here in our city. And so I think that this is a really valuable piece of legislation. We will be laying it over now, but we do intend to vote on it. We're working on some of the fiscal, trying to figure out fiscal, and want to get some feedback from folks. We are always willing to work on these things. But I think this is a really good piece of legislation, and we will vote it out on the committee before deadline. And so, Chair O'Driscoll, do you have anything to add at all?
No, Madam Chair. The concepts that we've been talking about today are very intriguing, and I think that Republicans do see the value. It's a matter of how we get from where we are, the steps that we're going to take to get there, to make sure that we're not getting other unintended consequences. We don't want to overshoot the mark. So if you have some amendment ideas that you want to run by members, you've heard their questions as the bill authors, we certainly are interested in trying to get to a solution. But I think we all agree that the bills need some additional work. It's a little rougher on the edges. And so looking to hear more about changes that the authors are bringing forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Greenman, would you like to wrap up, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm looking forward, Representative O'Driscoll and everybody, to your ideas. I think what you heard, and it's the last example, we don't actually know how they're setting prices, and these companies will not tell us. And so when you talk about, when we're talking about how we regulate this, in many cases when we're talking about loyalty programs, discounts, we're talking about all of these algorithms, it would be much easier if companies came to the table and said, here's how we're doing it, and we could work collectively with them. But their value is actually in keeping this from us. When we talk about the pricing revolution, right, this is a revolution, and we even saw this today in both of these bills. The people who are leading this revolution are the folks who are the businesses and their trade groups who are building these models to make more margins, to collect more money. And the people who are paying the cost, the consumers, the small businesses, the workers, are the ones who will pay the price. And what we're doing here, our job here, is to make sure that the incentives in our economy work for everybody. So we don't want to give these businesses a reason to consolidate, and we heard about the consolidation. The reason that the businesses are consolidating in many cases is the data. This would, if we don't do something about this, people will have more and more incentive to collect more and more data on us. That's a problem. We also don't want to give people the incentive to, I'm trying not to use the word, a swear word, to rip off.
Don't do it.
I won't do it. to rip off the people who are maybe most desperate. Right? If you need to buy a product right now, we know this. It's expensive to be poor. And if people have data on you, they will charge you more costs. So when I think about the work we can do here, you know, we should be on the side of the consumers, the small businesses, the workers, and not the trade associations and the businesses who actually will make money ripping us off. So I look forward to that work, and I look forward to working with you and getting a vote on this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. And with that, we will lay over House File 3749 as amended. 3794 as amended. And I don't know if that needs a gavel. Anyway, members, that's all we have on the agenda for today. Chair O'Driscoll, would you like to talk about tomorrow at all?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Tomorrow we are going to talk about deferral for state mandates in insurance policies, as well as a discussion on the reinsurance program, how it's going, some discussion for members about consideration for renewal of that for options available for future legislatures when they're looking at trying to find affordable insurance for Minnesotans.
Thank you very much. And with that, we are adjourned for the day. Thank you.